And perhaps you remember this is a passage of Scripture we began with last Lord's Day morning, found in Hebrews chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. I read it again to introduce the lesson today. Take heed, brethren, lest happily there shall be in any one of you an evil heart of unbelief in falling away from the living God. But exhort one another day by day, so long as it is called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Last Lord's Day morning, we talked about the deceitfulness of sin. Today, we want to talk about exactly the same subject. For the next few minutes, you perhaps will think that I'm going to preach exactly the same sermon. Even if I did, it would merely be doing what the Apostle Peter said when he stated that he was going to tell the same thing to the people that they already knew, so that he would bring to their remembrance those things they needed to know. Now that really is what the Apostle is saying here. He's saying that we need to exhort one another day by day. On a day-by-day basis, we need to exhort. Now why? We need to exhort one another for a particular reason, and that is so we will not fall away by the deceitfulness of sin. Now, there's something about sin that is very, very deceitful. There's something about sin that we need to be reminded about over and over and over and over. There's something about sin that we need to have people to tell us again and again and again and again to bring to our attention how powerful and how deceitful that sin really is. Last night, I was looking through Dave and Dina's wedding book of where they were married 6 years ago. And when I flipped across the picture of Bob Holman, there stood a man with rather dark hair and a rather slim frame. Now, I looked at Bob, and I kind of shook my head thinking what 6 years really has done to him. Now, as I was looking to Bob, it reminded me last week, Bob came in my office, and he gave me a good introduction to this sermon without me ever knowing it, without him ever knowing it. That is, there was a lady there, and the lady says, "Bob, how you doing?" He said, "Fine." If you're visiting with us, Bob has had a heart attack this past year, and they put him on a very stringent diet, told him that he had to lose quite a lot of weight. And we were all so proud of Bob that the way he was losing that weight, and so he said he was doing fine. And she asked him how he was doing with his food. And he kind of grinned, and he said, "You know, for a while, I was doing just perfectly." He said, "It's kind of like if there's an old snake in your living room." Said, "If somebody turns a poisonous snake in there, for about 6 weeks, you've got that snake on your mind all the time. Everywhere you go, you're looking for the snake, and you're going to make sure that the snake doesn't bother you. But if that snake just lays around and doesn't do anything for about 6 weeks, finally you just kind of get used to him, and you begin to ignore him." Now he said, "That's the way my diet has been." All right, now what Bob is saying really is true. Whether we're dealing with a poisonous rattlesnake, whether we're dealing with a diet that all of us are familiar with, or whether we're dealing with something that is far more deadly than any one of them, we're dealing with something of where we can be deceived. Human beings are deceived by the millions. Human beings are deceived, let me put it this way, not by the cities full. We're not deceived by the counties. We're not deceived by the states or the nations. We're deceived by the world. We're deceived in every generation. You can count every human being on the face of the globe, and every one of us has sinned because we have been deceived. Now, if we could just understand every day, as we begin to walk our life, really the danger that there is in sin, think how it would change our life. It would change it the same way it would if we had that rattlesnake in our living room. If we got up every day and we knew that there was a rattlesnake loose in our living room somewhere, wouldn't it make us walk very carefully? Wouldn't we really be concerned if we knew that and was reminded of it on a day-to-day basis? Now, the same thing is true of sin. And that is why the writer says, day by day, exhort one another so we won't be deceived. Now, I, again today, want to talk about the deception or how sin deceives. There are other things that we're going to be saying that we didn't say last week, but merely to get us into what we were talking about, let us look at some of the same charts, and perhaps we'll bring out some things that we didn't talk about last week. But what the point that we were making is this, and that is, as you began to study history, one thing that impresses you is that people who have lived before us, they've lived and died, and their history, their biography has been written, is that how many good men, how many preachers and elders, so forth, have fallen away from Christ in their latter life. It is really an amazing thing how that people can sacrifice, and I mean sacrifice for the Lord, in many, many physical realms, and yet somehow in their older life, when they don't have but just 3 or 4, 5, maybe 10 more years to live, something happens to when they do something and give up that spiritual life with God. It's mind-boggling. It's something you say, well, why in the world would anybody do that? Well, the answer to that is that men are deceived. Now, we talked about being deceived in various ways. And that is that sin fools us when a man is standing, or that we measure it wrong and fools a man when he's not standing in the right place. Not going to go into that anymore, other than to say that the right measuring standard is not measuring things by what we think is right or wrong, not measuring them by what other people think is right or wrong, not measuring them by what some creed book of religion says is right or wrong, but we must measure them by taking a stand firmly on God's Word. We need to live every day of our life with this attitude. That is, I need to understand that today, the way I live must be what I think is right. I must go out, and this afternoon, when I have a decision to make, I must do what I think is right. But I must always understand that doesn't necessarily make it right. I must always be willing to go back and measure my actions and measure my life by a thus saith the Lord. What has the Lord said? And whenever the Lord has spoken, and when I find that I'm doing something that I might think is right, but it's not right, then I must be willing to change my life. And so the first necessary thing is this, to truly take that stand on that. But then we talked about why people that take a stand on the Word of God can still be led astray. Why is it that somebody can preach the way I'm preaching today, that we must have a thus saith the Lord? And yet, how is it that somewhere between now and the time I die, that I can be led astray, led off, and get into embedded in sin so that I will lose my soul? Well, the first thing that we talked about is this. Because the deception of sin, or sin is so deceiving, because it always makes its appearance by its similarity to righteousness. We talked about it never appears as sin. Have you ever noticed that nobody ever invites anybody out to sin? Nobody ever says, would you like to go out and sin with me? Nobody ever does that. Nobody ever plans a trip or a vacation to go sin. We're going to take next week off, and I just can't wait because I'm going to go sin. Nobody ever does that. But how many times do we plan things, do we go places, do we do things, and we do them under the disguise of something when it's really sin? We illustrated it with these things. We illustrated it by showing that everybody is opposed to gambling, but yet churches are filled full of gambling today, but they do it on the basis of entertainment or on the basis of raising needed funds to take care of some orphans or to do some work in a foreign land. And so, churches today are just filled full of it, so much so that the state of Washington is having to revise their gambling laws to put restrictions upon how many times a week a church can have its bingo parties. And I forget now what it is, whether it's 2 or 3 times a week, they can have them. And then, if they have them only 2 times a week, then it's fundraising. If they have them 3 times a week, it becomes gambling, and the state will shut them down. Now, what are we doing? See, what are we doing when we get in a realm like this? The point is that we're calling something that's wrong by another name. We can call divorce an annulment. This is something that's rather interesting, that for hundreds of years in Roman Catholicism, they would not set forth or permit any Roman Catholic to get a divorce for any reason. Now, you and I know that the Bible teaches that there is one scriptural reason. That is that if your mate commits fornication, you have a right to put them away, divorce them, and remarry. And there is no other. That's it. Put a period there. That is what the Bible says. But Roman Catholicism didn't even recognize that. They said, we do not recognize it. We do not believe that you can even have it for that. So it was null, zero. Until somebody came up with an idea, and they said, well, we're not going to get a divorce. We're going to get an annulment. And what that was is this. That here it is, I've been married to my wife for 20 years. And I then happened to realize I really didn't love her when I married her. She deceived me. She acted as though she was one kind of a woman. I thought she was this kind, but as soon as I married her, then the real woman came out. That's not who I thought I was married. I was deceived. And so, in reality, I didn't marry the woman I thought I was marrying. And therefore, the marriage itself was not legal. See, the marriage itself was not right. It's just like buying a car. You come up to sell me a car, and you say, oh, this is a good car, the transmission's good. I mean, it's nothing wrong with this thing at all. I look it over, so I pay you $5,000 for your car. Because as though she was one kind of a woman, I thought she was this kind, but as soon as I married her, then the real woman came out. That's not who I thought I was married. I was deceived. And so, in reality, I didn't marry the woman I thought I was marrying. And therefore, the marriage itself was not legal. See, the marriage itself was not right. It's just like buying a car. You come up to sell me a car, and you say, oh, this is a good car, the transmission's good. I mean, it's nothing wrong with this thing at all. I look it over, so I pay you $5,000 for your car. I drive it home. And then when I get home, I find it has a bad transmission. I find that you put some oil and sawdust in there to take up room for the gears and so forth. Now, you've deceived me. Well, I can go back to the state. I can sue you. And the state will say, no, it was a bad deal. It's just as though Lowell never bought the car. So that's what I'm going to do with my wife. See? I'm not going to get divorced. Been living with her for 20 years. It's just like that car. I really never was married to her. Now, did that catch on? Yeah. See, that caught on. And today, throughout the land, there are hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of annulments that are given every year. No divorces. Nobody would think about a nasty thing like that. See, but it doesn't make any difference whether the mate is unfaithful or not. That has nothing to do with it. The mate could be just as faithful as they wanted to be, but I was deceived, so I'll get an annulment. Now that is the way these things are all changed around. Let's skip this. We talk this. Let's talk this one down here. Drugs help you think. This last week, I read in the paper where the state of Oregon is getting ready to vote on homegrown marijuana. That is, whether to legalize it or not. You can grow your own marijuana in your home, on your own property, then carry it with you wherever you want to, and it will be perfectly legal. Now, right at the time they're getting ready to vote, all of this cocaine and all of this dope problem has come up with these athletes dying. And so, all of a sudden, these people that's trying to get this passed, they're in problem. And so, they brought it out and they said, what are we going to do? Well, I would think they'd just give up. Why would anybody do such a thing as that? So, I read the article. And so, here is the way they're presenting it in Oregon today. And they will be voting on it this fall. Now you say, but not seriously. Let me tell you before I tell you the story. They've taken a survey and 54% of the Oregonians are in favor of it. So don't think we're just talking about something now. Now, how can you do that under this particular thing? All right, they said here is the way we're going to present it. We're not going to present it as legalizing homegrown dope. That sounds bad, doesn't it? What we're going to do is, we're going to go out and say, the law is no good. The present law is no good. It needs to be repealed because, number one, it's not working. It's obviously not working. Therefore, do away with the law. Nobody ever thinks about maybe enforcing it a little harder. But it's not working. Now, do they have a good argument for that? Yeah. That's how we got prohibition back taken off. Prohibition didn't work, so we start selling liquor again. That's the argument. Is that in harmony with moral principles? No, but it's the argument. All right, now another thing is, these people that are for homegrown dope are presenting themselves as being against dope. They are an organization against it. You say, it can't be. Nobody could do that. Listen to this argument. They say, here is our position. We are totally opposed to dope. Dope in every kind is destroying our youth, and it's killing our young people. And we want to fight it, and we want to rid our country of the great problem it is. So here's what we'll do. We're going to legalize homegrown dope. And we then will use it in a good way. See, those of us who are going to grow it there, we're going to use it in a good way. That's what the people who want a prohibition in, they're just going to drink in a good way. Now we're going to use it in a good way, and this will free all the policemen to go after the big guys that are bringing it in from other countries. And that's what we need, is to free the police. Now, we're going to do our part in freeing the police so they can get after the dope addicts. And not only that, think of the tax dollars that it will save. Instead of the policemen running around here arresting these little guys that are running around here not doing anything bad, just smoking a little homegrown dope. That's not bad stuff. I don't know how you tell whether the difference when a guy hits another person and snuffs out the life of another person, I don't know how you tell whether it's homegrown or whether it's brought in from another country. But the argument that's given is that we're going to use it properly. And then it will relieve all the tax dollars so that it can be funneled in then, and we're going to get after the dope, and so they're running a campaign on curing America's dope problem. Now, would you be for that? Would you vote for it? If you're going to vote for a law to cure the dope problem, why, certainly. How'd they do it? They did it by its similarity to righteousness. See, in presenting it in that way. Now, every sin that's ever been fostered upon man have brought in that way, and they brought in by so-called good men. I want to read you this passage right here again so that we keep this in mind. Now, this is the beloved Apostle Paul writing. I want us to know, if I were saying this, if I made up this and wrote it, you would call it very ugly. You would say Lowell doesn't have a proper attitude of love in his heart. He's bitter. He's mean, and he's ugly. So I call your attention to that now. This was the beloved Apostle Paul. This was a man that gave his life and died for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now what he says is really this. He says about these people that are going around teaching this false doctrine. He said, for such men are false apostles, deceitful workers, fashioning themselves into apostles of light, and no marvel. For even Satan fashioneth himself into an angel of light. It's no great thing, therefore, if his ministers also fashion themselves as ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works. And so, it's going to be presented by men of some kind of high stature that are reputed to be something. Now, this is what the Bible teaches that sin really is. So, think about it a minute. It's like Bob's rattlesnake. You turn a rattlesnake loose, you put it in there. Now, if every day somebody reminds you how bad rattlesnakes are, what they can do for you, how that, and they tell you some examples of what rattlesnakes do. Young man about 3 weeks ago over here in Seattle, another guy caught three rattlesnakes in eastern Washington, brought them over. He wanted to hold one. So the guy held the rattlesnake's head. He then reaches back to the rattlesnake's head to hold the rattlesnake. Now, there's no danger in that, is there? Not a bit. Now, if you do it right, you can hold it, you won't get hurt at all. So he reaches back there, and he reaches back just a little too far. The guy lets go, the snake turns around, bites him in the finger. That's a pretty good place to be bit, isn't it? Not a bad place. You're going to be bit, finger's a good place to be bit. They rushed him into Harborview. They put him in emergency. He went through all kinds of emergency, and it made the papers. And the doctor says that by pulling in every drop of medicine they had in the entire Seattle area, we barely, just barely, saved his life. And they said, if another person gets bit by a rattlesnake before we replenish it, they're in trouble. Now, if you could hear that every day, if you knew that every day of your life, it'd change your attitude. See, that's what we need to understand. Sin is of that nature that we need to understand how bad it really is. Now, the other thing that we talked about is how deceitful it is in its growth. The sin generally starts out rather small. Very few of us begin with any great big sins. Normally, you don't begin by robbing banks. You begin stealing off of your dad and mom, off of your neighbors, stealing something out of a store, and you graduate up into becoming a bank robber. Whatever sin that you're going to become engaged in, you generally start rather small and you go on up into something that is rather big. Now, we talked about this. We talked about the pattern for apostasy. How that these people back here in 2 Timothy 4:2, Paul said that they're going to be dissatisfied, or they're going to have itching ears. They're going to want to hear a preacher tell them nice stories. They're going to become dissatisfied with the gospel. They're going to demand that men tell them what they want to hear. Finally, they'll do away with the truth, and they'll turn aside into fables. And he just gives steps. Step one, step two, step three, step four. He said that's how that religious people can go from being somebody that believes in the Bible to somebody that no longer believes the Bible, but they believe in fables. They believe in the stories. Now don't be deceived. A great proportion of preachers who are preaching at the very hour that I'm preaching do not believe that the Bible is inspired of God. They do not believe that the stories are true. Keep that in mind. They are up today preaching to people and quoting the Bible, but when they quote it, they do not mean what you and I understand the Bible to say when they make those statements. When they talk about the resurrection of Christ, they do not believe that Christ ever raised from the dead. They mean that Jesus gave this story and said he would to give us the story of what we need to do when we get in trouble, when we get depressed, when we get down and out, and when we get the feeling really low. We need to grab a hold of ourselves, talk to ourselves, pick ourselves up, and start again. That's resurrection. He said that's the story. That is what is taught. And by doing that, we can see where they can go there. In all of these things, we talked about this. Now then, let's take a look, though, at something else. And that is that not only is it deceitful in the way that it is presented, not only is it deceitful in the way that it grows, but it is deceitful in its consequences. And that is in the final end result. I want us to think about the end result of sin and see really what sin actually is. That when you get involved in sin, unless you stop that sin, unless you kill that sin, right here is good illustration, really, of where sin actually is. Now, all of us know these stories, most of these stories. Take Adam and Eve. Everybody knows the story of Adam and Eve. Now, let us suppose that Satan, as he came and had that serpent to talk to Eve, let us suppose that Satan had told Eve the whole story. Let us suppose he had told her the consequences. Now, he only told her the first part. Stop to think what he told her. He said, Eve, hath God said, thou shalt not eat of this? Yeah. And he said, the day thou eatest thou, thou shalt surely die. Now, he said, that really is not true. You won't die, but here is what will happen. It will give you knowledge, and you will have knowledge equivalent to God. Wouldn't that be nice? You see, there's your first salesman that's trying to sell some kind of miraculous medicine. You go eat the fruit, and then you will have the same knowledge that God has. Doesn't that sound good? Now then, that within itself sounds awful good. He said, she looked out and she saw it, that it was desired to be looked on. It was pretty. And it was desirable to eat. It would taste good. Everything about that fruit looked good. Now let's suppose, as she reached up to pick the fruit, he'd have said, "Let me tell you one thing, Eve. Now I want you to eat it. But here is what it'll cost you. If you take a bite of that fruit off of that tree, from the moment you take a bite, you will begin to degenerate, deteriorate, grow old, and you're going to die. Not only are you going to die, but you're going to deceive your husband, and he's going to sin, and he's going to die. And not only that, but then God will curse this earth with all kind of thorns and all kind of things, to where every man will no longer be able to go out and make his living in a Garden of Eden, but will have to go out and fight all of these elements, barely scratching out a living, and he's going to make a living by the sweat of his face. The only way he can do it is sweat is going to pour off of him. Now that's going to be a problem. But not only that, Eve, but every time that a woman is born, when they conceive a child, when they bear a child, it's going to be done in great, great agony and great pain. But not only that, but there's going to be a lot of disease in this world. And some of those little babies are going to be born deformed. Some of them are going to be born mentally ill. Some of them are going to be born in a very terrible condition. But even the very best ones, those that are pronounced perfectly healthy, and the mamas and daddies take them home and are so proud, every one of them are going to spend a life of sorrow and sickness. Every one of them is going to get sick during their youth. There's some of them are going to die while they're young. But every one of them, if they don't die while they're young, will grow old and spend the remaining part of their lives wishing for the death to come. And every human being that will ever live is going to die. Now that's a consequence. Go ahead and take a bite. Would she have taken a bite? Think about taking a bite under those circumstances. But Satan is never going to tell you the consequences. Think of Solomon, how awesome that is. Think of Solomon, how that Solomon there was a man that prayed to God that God would give him wisdom so that he might rule properly, and a good man, a fine man. And then, some way or another, he got carried away and was deceived, and he brought in all of these wives, and the big thing is he brought in heathen wives. Now when he brought in these heathen wives, suppose somebody stopped him and said, "Solomon, let me tell you about these women. Now I know that these women are desirable, and I know that you would like to have them. But here's what's going to happen. Some of these days you, as David's son, are going to succumb to their desires. And you're going to go out here and build a temple and make an idol so they can worship. And some of these days they're going to seduce you, and you are going to worship at an idol's temple. And as you go out, Solomon, you will turn in to a first-class idolater, a ruler of the land of God's people. But Solomon, that's not all. You're going to turn into an idolater, but because of your activities, you then are going to bring forth a young man, and that young man that's going to rule the kingdom is going to grow up, and he will divide the kingdom. The kingdom will divide and tell about all the problems that the Jews have. Now, Solomon, I know that that woman is pretty. And I know that you really desire her. But if you take her, there is the end result. Do you suppose Solomon would have ever taken one had he known that? But Solomon was not given the consequences. As you get down, take David. David, Solomon's daddy. As he committed that sin that we all know about. As he was out there, and as he was looking over and he saw that beautiful woman, and he desired her. Now just stop to think. As he desired her, and he sent for her to come over. If somebody could have been there. If Satan could have said, now while she's coming, let me explain, David. You're getting ready to have one of the most pleasant evenings you've ever had. You probably have never spent an evening with the passionate love and joy an emotional release that you're getting ready to have tonight. The greatest love affair probably man has ever known, you're getting ready to enjoy tonight. But let me tell you something. She has a husband, and she will come with child. And then when you find that out, it's going to worry you to death until you become a deceiver and you will call her husband home. And then you will deceive him, but you'll try, but he'll not be deceived. And finally, David, you'll have to murder that man. You'll have to kill him to cover up your story. But not only after you have murdered him, but I'm going to tell a prophet by the name of Nathan, and he's going to come and confront you, and the world is going to know what you did. And this, the story of what you're getting ready to do, what you're getting ready to do tonight, will be written in a book. It will be published in every country, of every land, of every nation, as long as man lives on the face of the earth. What you're getting ready to do is going to be exposed to everybody. And then when your little baby's born, I'm going to take its life. Have a good evening. Enjoy yourself. She's knocking at your door. Would David have opened the door? You see, if we could see the consequence of sin, if we could see the terrible disaster that there is down at the end, would we ever open the door? But when sin comes into our life, we never see the consequence because we look at the pleasure of the moment. As you look at all of those apostasies, let's just look at them very quickly. As you go back and you look at the ones we talked about last week, the first apostasy, how that there in about between 100 and 120 A.D., right after the last apostles died, the people there in the church, some of the leaders, they began to get aspirations of becoming a little greater. And so in the eldership, one man was elected to become the president of the elders. And so we take this president of the eldership, and then we give him a special name. We call the other men elders, but we reserve the title of bishop for him. Is that really bad? Oh, I know it's wrong. I know it's wrong. I know the Bible doesn't teach it. I'm talking about, is that really bad? If you heard of somebody doing that, would you just scream and faint when you hear something like that? I wouldn't. I just say, well, the person, that they're overstepping their bounds. They're unscriptural. They're doing something that's not right. But now stop the thing. Stop the thing. When that first man took that position as president of the elders, and he took the title as bishop, if somebody could have stepped into that elders meeting and said, now, let me tell you what's going to happen. You'll get some enjoyment out of this because you will get an honor and a glory of men. But here's what's going to happen. Other congregations are going to hear of this and they're going to do the same thing. And in a little while, you're going to become dissatisfied and you bishops will get together and then you will vie for a higher title. And finally, in 500 years, this is going to take a long time, a lot longer than David. But in 500 years, there's going to be five of you men that are going to be fighting for the top. And when you fight for the top, there it is that you're going to set up a universal church. And you're even going to divide that into the Eastern and Western churches. And from then on, that huge body will spend its time for the next several hundred years trying to destroy the written Word of God. Burning the Bibles by the truckloads. Killing the people who translate. Are you sure you want to go out and introduce yourself as the president of the eldership? You take this second one. That happened last century. We've all heard of Alexander Campbell. He's the man that led the battle. Very brilliant man. Very charismatic man. A man that when he determined to do something, it was almost impossible to hold him back because he had so much power and so much influence. And so he put his efforts behind the missionary society. Now, Campbell's motives were good. I don't know of one motive that he had was a bad motive in this whole thing. What he wanted to do was to put all of the sums of money of different congregations, a certain percentage of it, under one organization so they could lump it together and have a huge sum of money to spread the gospel throughout the whole world. They weren't going to use any of it for him. He wasn't going to siphon off any of it, and he didn't. And so he did that so he could preach the gospel around the world. And they voted on it, and it carried. Now let's suppose right before the final vote, somebody could have stepped in, Satan or somebody, and said, now you're doing a good job. Really, there's not much wrong with two churches combining their funds. I mean, what is immoral about that? What could be wrong about that? I don't see anything wrong about it. But now here's what you're going to do. If they just said, here will be the consequence. What you will do is that you're going to do this, and all these churches are going to do it, and then there are going to be people out there that are going to be crying, there's no Bible authority, and you are going to go ahead and do it anyway. The younger generations will grow up and say, Campbell and that generation did things without Bible authority, so we also will do things without Bible authority. And then they're going to bring in instrumental music. They then are going to bring in reverend for the preacher's title. They will bring in all of these various things, and finally, they will bring them in, keep bringing them in, keep pushing the Bible away. We don't need the Bible. We don't need the Bible. Until today, in 1986, this movement will be known as the Disciples of Christ, and every preacher who preaches in that denomination will not believe in the virgin birth of Christ. They will renounce the Bible as being inspired in any sense at all, except the same way Shakespeare was inspired. Or if I write a poem, they say that's inspired. You say, what do you mean inspired? It means you just felt like writing a poem. They're just a bunch of people who felt like writing the Bible. They do not believe in the resurrection of Christ. They do not believe in any of this. Now, Campbell, for a while you put all that money together for about 5 to 6 years, man, you're going to do a lot. You're going to send that gospel out. It will be sent out there. A lot of good things are going to come. But there will be the end result of it. What do you suppose Alexander Campbell would do right now if we could call him up from the dead to preach next Sunday and tell him and show him this week of what's happening? What do you suppose that he would say if he could see the consequence of just that little sin? In our apostasy today, people that I know, that my age, no longer believe in the Word of God, no longer practice New Testament Christianity. I wouldn't have believed it in the farthest imagination of my mind. As men back at that time, who were older men and preaching at that day, they were warning, the same warning I'm warning today, they were telling the people, if you do these things, the day will come when you will be using instruments, you will be doing this, and you will be doing that. Never in anybody's mind did they ever understand that in the church in Wenatchee, Washington, that they would not only use instrumental music and use all of these things, but their preacher would be selected as the man that would be the head of the preacher society in that realm, would be asking every individual, every denomination in the world to come in and saving souls and sending them into all of these various denominations and writing out pamphlets that he is the greatest president that society has ever had. I read his letter. Never in the farthest imagination could I ever have imagined or heard anybody say that that preacher and an elder in that church went into casting out demons after they saw the movie. So if you need a demon today removed from you, you can go to the Church of Christ in Wenatchee, the east side Church of Christ. I don't know what they're doing at the west side now, but you can go to the east side and you can have the demons cast out of you. Isn't it something? You can't imagine. You can't imagine the consequence of all of this. And so what we find is Isaiah says that when you get involved in all of that, what you're doing is that you're having adder's eggs and a spider's web. That's what sin does to you. Sin grabs you up like a bug in a spider's web. And then you're in there, and before you know it, you're eating the adder's eggs, and that's a poisonous snake, and your life is going to be snuffed out. Do you see why when we talk about the deceitfulness of sin, that we can go back and we can read of where the apostle says, day by day, as long as it's called today, exhort one another so you won't fall away and have your heart hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Should there be one in our audience today that understands that your life is not pleasing to God, if today that you need to be washed in the precious blood of His Son, would you let it be known while we stand and while we sing the first stanza of the song that's been selected?